It's my very great pleasure both to welcome you here to the LSE this evening and to introduce Sir Alan Shepherd, who really needs no introduction to those of us at the school, or indeed to this hall, which he remembers of old, although probably not so beautifully upholstered and appointed. It's always nice to invite our students back to give lectures. It, as I say, it always gives them a chance to get their own back. Well, before coming to the LSE as a student, Alan was at the Ilford County School, and his roots are very much in that part of London, and he's perhaps almost as well known, at least now, as Mr. London, and one of those who are trying to bring back a sense of London pride and a London community, as well as, of course, his enormous reputation as a manager in private enterprise, and hence his title tonight, Private Enterprise, Public Responsibility. He's a man who has more than done his bit on both sides of that equation. When he left the LSE, he went to work for Ford. It's very interesting how in various periods of British industrial history, different companies seem to have been nurseries for the industrial leaders of the next generation. And certainly Ford, during the time Alan was there, was a sort of kindergarten for British managers. He left Ford, went to other parts of the motor industry, but really achieved, I suppose, his national reputation as being chairman, eventually, of Grand Met, Grand Metropolitan, where he's still president and still influential and active. But most of his time now is really spent on public rather than private enterprise and responsibility. And knowing Alan as I do, I know he'll talk about both sides of that equation, but he'll talk best impromptu. So he's kindly agreed to answer questions after his prepared part of the talk, and I look forward to that, as well as to the bits you've got written down on the paper there, Alan.
You don't really just tear it up, do you?
No. On the contrary, one other thing, can I say to you, one thing that you'll remember from this lecture theatre, conspicuous by absence except for one or two, are students. At this time of year, given the current climate in the country, students are revising or taking their examinations.
Seems so,
you know, that it's that kind of entrepreneurship which they're showing. Alas, that's just an accident of the calendar and no reflection on you. But Alan.
Thanks, John. Yes, it's, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be here. As John was just saying, it's the first time I've ever actually tackled giving a talk or speech or whatever it is in this theatre, although I've been recipient of many, and when, as you say, the chairs weren't actually padded, John. I'm glad to see we've added value or gone up market. The one other word before I begin, it's a great privilege to give the Clifford Barclay lecture because of the huge links that Clifford Barclay had with the whole subject of management education, which is dear to certainly my heart and probably just about everybody's heart in this room. So it's a great honour to have that linkage, and I thank everybody for that honour. If I get even more incoherent than usual, we had this lunchtime. I didn't actually stay for lunch, but a kind of pre-lunch. We had a group of our new Russian business colleagues in, and by the time we'd finished drinking toast to each other in vodka, I felt decidedly unsteady, but they didn't even seem to notice, so I must have proved something about the future relationship. But as John says, what I would like to talk about for a few words, then throw open for any questions you may want to have on anything I've said or haven't said, is private enterprise, public responsibility, and the interface thereof. It's pretty rare for me to actually quote the Greek philosophers. It's not normally part of my day's work, but Metaxa, Brandy is quite different, but Greek philosophers comes more difficult, with greater difficulty. But let me just do so on the occasion today. Plato in the Republic said that shopkeepers are usually not strong enough people to be useful in any other job. Now, let me begin in saying, if there are any of our customers tucked away in here, I don't think David Sainsbury's around or anything, I hasten to say that from a Grand Met point of view, I'm not certain about Plato anyway. But he went on to declare that shopkeepers are even inferior to merchants, because merchants at least have the courage to go off on business to foreign parts. It was obviously part of Michael Heseltine's export drive. In his description of the ideal state, Plato places traders in the third and lowest category of society, the category that consists of those who are wholly unfit to take any part in government. So that's what Plato thought about business and businessmen, not very much. After him, Aristotle came along, and he didn't have a single good word to say about private enterprise or businessmen. In fact, it was about 2,000 years before Adam Smith finally surfaced and said, as you all know, in The Wealth of Nations, the prejudices of some political writers against shopkeepers and tradesmen are altogether without foundation. But this turned out to be only a very brief respite from the continuous barrage of criticism against traders, because as we know, we then entered into the collective socialist, call it what you like, debate, which has gone on for the last 100 years. And that put even more pressure, with socialist writers claiming that business was a source of injustice and produced nothing but poverty and revolution. In fact, it's only about the last 20 years or so that this adverse view of business has ceased to occupy what was an intellectual high ground. It was a bad thing to be in trade. Going back to the Ilford County High School, I remember my headmaster, who when I applied to go to the London School of Economics and to study industry, to specialise in industry and trade, I didn't actually tell him I was going for the interviews. And the only reason I got in, by the way, was, as John's heard this story, happened to be a true story. It was the funeral day, and tell you how long ago it was. It was the funeral day of Lasky. So it was only myself and the porter here, and he thought I was quite good. But the headmaster literally was quite strong against this guy who could have studied something worthwhile at a place like, he took a history degree at, I think it was Cambridge, could have studied something worthwhile going to the London School of Economics to study industry and trade. More recently, if you get right up to date with attitudes towards business, then it's become clear that however noble some of the Marxist dogma sounded in theory, in practice it has had great difficulty in getting it to work. And the collapse of the Berlin Wall symbolised the end of some of that socialist thinking and collective thinking. And the battle of ideas has now to some extent swung towards the new style, and I'll come back to that, not the old style, the new style, capitalism. And more of that in 1 second. What this doesn't all mean, by the way, is that everybody entirely approves of business or businessmen. You've only got to read the newspapers. Corporate ethics remains a high-profile topic for discussion, and the business case certainly hasn't been helped by some of the very high-profile crises and disastrous events that have taken place in business, without mentioning any particular names, with pension funds and God knows what else. It's an issue, though, where responsible management, I take very seriously the whole issue of corporate governance. If you go into the reaction of British companies to the Cadbury report on corporate governance, for example, then there's no doubt that the whole of that has got a very high degree of attention and priority. However, that isn't the main subject I want to talk about today. I think major investors, plus the basic honesty of most businessmen, and I've found in 40 years in business, I haven't found many dishonest businessmen. I've found people who will out negotiate you with a wink of a cry and have hysteria and everything else, but the but I haven't found many people who are straight crooks, but maybe it's because I'm too naive to notice. But in my view, the check and balance of that kind of position on ethics is the Cadbury sort of thing. It is imbalanced, and it, as I say, it isn't that main aspect that I want to talk about today. At present, the free enterprise system and business activity, whilst not openly applauded by most sections of society, at least is now accepted without the hostile criticism that, as I say, it may have suffered some at various times over the last 2,000 years. This mustn't, on the other hand, encourage business people to be complacent. They will not do very well if they don't actually have social responsibility and the relationships of business with the communities in which they operate very high on their personal and their company's agenda. And I'm happy to say that in this country, as in the States, which is probably still slightly ahead of us, but we are probably ahead of the continent, many of the most successful and best-run corporations do have social responsibility very firmly on their agenda, and that's been true now progressively over recent years. Businesses are very much aware that their success is heavily dependent on the health of the communities in which they operate and their acceptance by these communities. They are also aware that the relationship of business and society, which seems so harmonious at present, could come under increasing pressure as a consequence of the sheer size and spread of modern trading corporations. Self-employment, small business, will grow continuously over the coming years, as it is now, and will provide most of employment growth around the world. However, in many sectors, being big has always been important, and increasingly nowadays has become vital. That's true not only in the motor industry, where I was for 18 years, as John described, but it's also true in the food and drink business, which is where I am now. Only very big companies can actually afford the global approach to markets, responding quickly to consumer needs and so on. And therefore, by the nature of the thing, one must have quite large companies. They will have the financial muscle, they will be able to attract and hold people of the right caliber to give continuous innovation that one needs if you're actually going to stay alive and stay ahead. Only very big outfits can in fact take a worldwide approach and be looking at markets as far away as, say, Shanghai and Chicago. In Grand Met, we saw the need 6 years ago to increase our size and our geographic spread and to convert Grand Met from what it was, which was the product of a brilliant entrepreneur for the first 20 years and was a very successful company in many businesses, in many places, doing many different things. And we decided that we had to focus and become world leaders in what we were going to specialise in. And it was all driven by this need to actually have a large enough base from which to operate. This trend, however, towards corporate bigness, which will continue, incidentally, with the organic growth of brands, with the opening up of new markets, and so revolutions going on in business at the present moment of time in what was the old communist bloc, China, Vietnam, and so on. More mergers, more acquisitions, more alliances. In the first half of the next century, there's no doubt that some of the world's markets, although, as I repeat again, the majority of people will still be employed by relatively small firms, but some of the large companies, global companies, will be of huge size. These corporations will be so large, in fact, you could argue that they already are, that they will often influence the lives of people as much as some of the smaller national governments. The companies will determine the living standards of thousands, tens of thousands, maybe millions of people. and make an impact on the economies of particular countries and areas which are of great importance to those areas. The firm's geographical spread will make them citizens of the world rather than citizens of any single country. They will not owe allegiance to any single state, even though their culture and their headquarter location happens to be in a particular country. Going back to Grand Met, I mean, so we will argue that we are one of the best French companies that exists. We are one of the best Irish companies. We're certainly one of the most successful American companies, chosen by the president of one of his top most admired countries. We're the only non-British, non-American-based one. We hope, a good British citizen, and so on. So we're, to some extent, one is a citizen of the areas where one operates. These companies, such as Grand Met, will not feel obliged to support the exports of that particular state. In fact, the whole concept of exports is a term which increasingly, for a large corporation, doesn't mean anything. What we're driven by is, what is the best pattern of production, what is the best pattern of sourcing around the world to meet the consumer's requirement for the investment in research, investment in quality, and for low prices and costs. We can't possibly feel obligated to generate employment in a particular country. We've actually got to be in a position to be able to generate productive employment in every country in which we operate. So truly, a lot of these large corporations, and it will become increasingly true, are citizens of the world. Something that national politicians find it quite difficult to understand and to deal with. Incidentally, any attempt to say, well, we should strangulate these at birth, because they're obviously rather a dangerous development, would mean that we would automatically be sub-optimising on consumer choice and, in fact, on the growth of world living standards. Because these companies aren't becoming big as some form of ego trip by the chairman or the shareholders or whatever. It's because they're driven very much by market forces. These businesses will, in fact, possess great power. And because they are transnational, as I've said, they do not relate to a single national government. So how will governments, and in fact nations, react to the growing evidence of some of this corporate power and independence during the next century as this progresses? I think there are two possible scenarios. The first is the pessimistic one, which I don't share, and that is that we will see the gradual development of fear, suspicion, and even outright hostility back against business, a return, in fact, to the collectivist scenario and also to protectionism. And you see bits of that popping up every day. But I think the way that things will go is the optimistic one, and this is what I'd like to say a few more words about. I think that there will be increasing signs of a scale that so far it's quite difficult for a lot of people to imagine, of a partnership between business and society, and particularly local communities. If the leaders of multinational corporations ensure that the power they wield is used responsibly, if they respect the interests of the different groups in their strategic planning, if they can achieve balance in a set of widely different objectives, they will do more to avoid conflict with their local communities and to develop economic growth than is possible in any more closed-down way. In fact, the new style, consumer-driven capitalism, that I will come back to later, is what actually faces most of those companies. As I sometimes put that, whereas most politicians face an election every 4 years, 5 years, or whatever. In business, if you're running a company, part of a team running a company which has got global brands, then every time a housewife, or should I say a house person, goes in to shop, they are actually passing a vote on whether or not what they think of your company, as well as what they think of your products. So in fact, we stand for election daily. And believe me, if you don't believe that, the consumers will vote you out. Together with the trend towards self-employment, I think that business can, in fact, bring wealth, not poverty, and it can bring harmony, not revolution. But as I said a little earlier, socialism and state intervention have failed everywhere that they've been introduced. Public ownership has also proved to be very difficult to make efficient and non-bureaucratic. Private enterprise is so far winning the battle of ideas. But even in its hour of triumph, old-style capitalism has absolutely died and is being transformed to the type of consumer capitalism that I just described. In the world today and even tomorrow, peoples and governments will no longer tolerate a 19th century or early of 20th century approach to business, an approach which is very much driven entirely by short-term profit. The whole aim of just having one boss, the owner, the shareholder, doesn't work in modern society. In future, successful businesses will not be run solely for the interests of shareholders. Already it's beginning to happen that most of the world's successful companies recognise stakeholders other than their shareholders, their employees, for example. After all, most of them are manager people themselves, so they are employees themselves. Their suppliers, their distributors and their local communities. As you probably know, the Royal Society of Arts is currently undertaking a very full inquiry into what they've called tomorrow's company. And let me quote you, because I think it summarises it very well, from their recent interim report issued a few weeks ago. And it quotes as follows. We believe that to achieve sustainable success, tomorrow's company must take an inclusive approach. In an inclusive approach, success is not defined in terms of a single bottom line, nor is its purpose confined to the needs of a single stakeholder. Each company makes its own unique choice of purpose and values and has its own model of critical business processes from which it derives its range of success measures. But tomorrow's company will understand and measure the value which it derives from all its key relationships and thereby be able to make informed decisions when it has to balance the trade-off of conflicting claims of customers, suppliers, employees, investors, and the communities in which it operates. And that's the end of that quote. I think that actually catches what I'm trying to say quite well. The RSA are still doing ongoing work on precisely what that means and talking to a lot of people from the academic side, from voluntary sector side, as well as from business and politics and so on. It's an ironic comment on the some of the politics of this century that, in fact, if you look at it and look at that statement, the chasm between the ideals of Karl Marx and those of Marx and Spencer has narrowed to the point where it hardly exists at all. Many of the attitudes of large companies such as Marx and Spencer have got quite a lot of that empowerment of the individual and so on, which Karl Marx was in part talking about. Certainly the method of achieving it is kind of, in some cases, quite different, of course. Is this vodka, John? Or?
Alas.
In the next century, everyone will take for granted what relatively few people recognise today, that business is critically dependent on the community in which it exists. There's no way that business can operate in isolation from the community. It cannot. Its whole value judgments and so on must fit within a complete pattern of what the people who make up all the component groups around it are looking for. The community is not only, after all, the community is not only our neighbour. It's out there are also our customers, our suppliers, employees, and increasingly with the spread of share ownership, our owners. Without the support of the communities in which business operates, we will certainly not be able to function efficiently or prosper in the longer term. It is the steadily growing realisation of this fact by a majority of business leaders that is changing the nature of private enterprise. The system has evolved by recognising that business has a duty to safeguard the interests of not one but several sets of people, its owners, its employees, including the whole subject of how you empower individuals, and the whole of society. Now, By now, you probably think that this sounds like speech by somebody who's a bit kind of left of centre. As John knows, I'm slightly to the right of Genghis Khan and still moving. We have not gone soft in business. What we're talking about is hard-headed business, but those business decisions must be made within an overall context of understanding, as I say, of people, be they customers, be they employees, as well as the community groupings in which we operate. We're not certainly in business. The people who think this way are not a bunch of do-gooders. We're no less determined to increase our profits and our earnings per share than the next person. In fact, we would say that we're attempting to prove this statistically at the present moment. It's quite difficult. That if you take, for example, the degree of personal volunteerism that goes on within one of our businesses, let's take, for example, Burger King. If you get a higher degree of personal volunteerism in a particular area, grouping of Burger Kings, do you actually find there's a positive correlation, very strong positive correlation, between people who give that type of part of themselves to the local community with actually being good business people and actually running and performing successfully in their stores? And we're on the edge of actually managing to prove that statistically, which if we do, it would be quite a breakthrough. Other companies are trying to do the same thing. In other words, it's got nothing to do with do-gooding. It's to do with actually the realities of modern life. At GrandMed, our determination to support the community does not come from feelings of altruism. It comes from the knowledge that this sort of activity, as I've said, must be part of the whole of our corporate strategy. Community involvement, employee empowerment, and increased earnings are not opposites. They're all facets of the same triangle or whatever. Let me explain some of that and give you some examples of our thinking. Because GrandMed's brand appeal is to people, men and women, with a bit of spare money, we tend to have added value brands. I don't mean expensive ones. We have a very direct commercial interest in the prosperity of the communities in which we operate, in which we sell. It is this prosperity that determines the size of our markets and enables people to buy our brands. This is equally true of both developed and developing nations. I was saying to one of the, through a translator who managed, I think she managed to translate what I was saying, that I was talking to one of the Russians today, and I said, do you realise that GrandMed could solve your alcoholism problem? And so he said, what do you mean? We were both drinking vodka at the time. And I said, if we could get to the stage where the whole of your market became more branded, then people couldn't afford to be drunks. They would actually get on and just buy our slightly added value products and enjoy them, rather than just swilling down rubbish. So it's an example of how what can be appear to be a cross purposes isn't at all. Let me take another example of our link with community efforts and how that fits with our commercial interests. The quality of employees. Recruiting and retaining the best people is critical to success. I always say that management is about three things: vision, it's about people, and it's about common sense, which is pretty rare. And the people bit of that is, if you had to choose one of those three, and you can't really, but if you had to choose one of them, you'd choose people. But I sometimes say, if you gave me a choice of going into a difficult war, a difficult industry, if you want, with the right group of people, or taking an inadequate team into what appear to be a pushover, then there's no doubt I would go into the difficult war with the right team, because there aren't any easy victories nowadays in business. But giving people greater control over their destiny is a big part of our community involvement on education links. Today's management is all about bringing the best out of people. It's all about what I call orchestrating anarchy. It's all about getting people who are rebels and rebelling and want to do it different. And you've got to orchestrate that anarchy. It sure as hell isn't to do with strict delegation and control. So we find that that type of person, some of the best people, if you want to employ them, will actually look right through at the company behind the people they're meeting, and will actually decide whether they actually like what they see of the company. So they actually, when they get to a company, want to feel part of that company, want to feel proud to be part of that company. And to that extent, it's very important, the whole of our community program, in attracting and holding top quality people who are in their own way kind of rebels and instigators. Let me give one final example of the importance of this, of everything I'm talking about, which I stress again is kind of practical stuff and not theoretical nonsense, to it from GrandMet. GrandMet worked very closely with communities to raise their level of education and technical skill. We do this in all types of ways, school links, you know, involving teachers in some of our training programs. We're big advocates of investors in people and so on. The whole of this is to do with developing prosperity, because obviously if you have a low-skilled environment, you're going to end up over time with a low standard of living, and we're not interested in low standard of living. We want people's living standards to rise so that they can afford our products. We also want to have a level of people who are skilled and in the whole, recognizing the whole of that is a kind of learning for life process, and will develop within GrandMet. And we find that getting school links early on is an important part of that. Volunteerism of getting our people out into schools, probably in their own time, talking to schools and getting involved, school governors and whatever, is all part of the way of getting to know the real world and encouraging the type of lift in education and technical skills that we need in business. So I'd just like to mention, having said that, let me mention one more, because we are a branded goods company, and I probably ought to say something there about the much-discussed subject between accountants of goodwill, but I won't talk about it in an accounting sense. A large and growing number of shareholders, of customers, suppliers, and, of course, the housewife, houseperson, as I said, when they're looking at a company, actually look right through that company and decide what they think of it. And if you, in fact, are not a company that is actually living up to your own reputation, clearly you've got to live up to it in terms of quality and value for money for the products and so on. But if you're not actually being a true citizen, if you're not actually developing one's own employees, if you're not going through the process of working in local communities in the way I've described, then clearly the shareholders are not going to be keen. I've never had any, we spend on community projects £18 million a year in GrandMet, which is about 2% of our profits, and worldwide. And I've never had a single shareholder at the annual general meeting, I've been chairman 7 years, actually stand up and criticise why you're spending our money, because it is their money after all, I'm only an agent, I'm one of the shareholders, but I'm only a small one. Why are you spending our money on these projects and so on? We've had people stand up and obviously ask, why are you spending that amount in America and that amount in Britain? Why don't you take, I'm very interested in that Burger King Academy kind of dropouts thing that you're doing in the States. Why don't you take it to Britain, answer we just have, and so on. Quite interesting that I've never had any criticism, yet you listen to a lot of company chairmen, they will say, can't do that, you know, God, the shareholders really have a go. We actually, in one of our community brochures, ask Norwich Union, one of our three largest shareholders, to if they wanted to comment on our community project. And I thought they gave a very honest reply, which I'll proceed to misquote, not deliberately. They said, whilst GrandMet continues to achieve the growth of earnings per share that it's achieved recently, we fully and completely support their community involvement. And I thought that was an absolute brilliant city answer. goodwill is very important to us. I mean, say it's, as I say, it's to do with getting the right caliber of people in, although a lot of that is the culture of the business as well. It's to do with that if you work well with local communities, it's got nothing to do with bribing people or something. If you talk to them, they'll talk to you. And therefore, when you go up with a planning project or whatever in a particular community, if you've treated them decently over a decade, they'll kind of treat you decently. They may say no, but at least they go for the process of talking you through it and why. And as I've mentioned, the importance of the same with one's employees. It's critical, in my view, that you can't just be nice in a situation. But you can at least behave decently. I mean, say if you're going to have to, for example, make people redundant, which one has to do, and if you're going to go in for plant closures and so on, sure as hell you can communicate it in the best way. Sure as hell you can actually talk to. You can make certain, as I put it, based on my Leyland days, that I promised myself after Leyland that I would never have walking wounded round any operation that I was round in. I generally go on to say with that I would shoot them first, but that sounds rather vicious. But it's better actually to actually tell them the truth rather than half lie to them. So a lot of these things, a lot of these community attitudes and so on, come back to you in form of goodwill, as I say, with your investors, your employees, your customers, or whatever. And that's something which is very difficult to measure, but quite fundamental. Incidentally, none of this that I've described to you makes managing easier. It's an extra dimension on the task of management. It, in my view, makes it much more interesting, much more, I don't know what the word rewarding means, I don't mean salaries. I won't get into that topic. But the task of management today is you've got to actually be a leader. I'm not saying I'm very good at it, but at least I can observe other people. You've actually got to be a leader, you've got to inspire people. I mean, so the excitement is to actually bring out from people, be it local communities, be it employees, be it a small firm acting as a supplier. You've got to bring out of them, draw out of them levels of achievement they never thought they were capable of having. In commercial terms, the effort of actually achieving this level, this management, is amply justified, in my view, for the reasons I've said to you earlier on. It ensures less political interference if actually business gets involved, as John and I have just been in the meeting this afternoon on London First, actually talking to the various political parties and so on about aspects of London. It means that one is drawn into some of those debates at a much earlier stage. It reduces the chance of the confrontation, the negative collective protectionist approach that I described earlier on as a large company. And this applies, I've tended to comment mainly on from a British context, but it's very much true in a developing area. I mean, say if you're developing in China, if you're developing in wherever you want to go, Mexico, Latin America, and so on, you need to actually be right at the cutting edge of doing things in the most sensible and best way if you're going to succeed. But people sure as hell do notice. I mean, so you may not get any advantage for a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. Sure as hell they remember, because there are a lot of people who will be observing and watching. So let me try and pull all this together and summarize. Our vision of the future suggests that although there will be a large amount of self-employment and small company employment, there will be large multinational businesses which dominate some of our world markets. They will be immensely powerful. Their managers will and must understand that their power must always be tempered by a sense of corporate responsibility. They will build partnerships with government and communities so that their interests and those of the people they influence will not come into conflict. Business and community will recognize, and I think this will happen increasingly, their mutual dependence. Old-style capitalism as I've said, is evolving into a 21st century system of free enterprise, which is widely accepted, and because of its benefits, will be widely shared, will be welcomed. We believe that successful businesses of the next century have already recognized the trend of these events and have revised their long-term strategies accordingly. Certainly Graham Met is in that camp, as are many other successful companies. Private enterprise and public responsibility are increasingly being seen as matters which are essentially in partnership rather than in conflict, which has often been the dialogue of this century. There has been a quiet revolution in business and community relationships in Britain over the last decade. As I've said, we're still in some ways behind America, who always had that we-ism approach. How do we tackle that problem? We will look after it. For many years, we got to the habit of saying they will look after it, and we never found them. So increasingly, Britain is now out there on that cutting edge, and in many instances, we are certainly up with the very best practices, maybe ahead of the continent. This quiet revolution that has taken place in the last 10 or 15 years is, in my view, changing the whole face of the interface of private enterprise and public responsibility. And I think it will become an approach, an attitude, which will be absolutely commonplace in the years to come and will set the pattern for certainly the way the whole business, the way the whole business operates in the next century. Thanks, John, for the opportunity of talking, and thank you for the opportunity of giving this talk. I hope I've given plenty of time for questions on what I haven't covered as well as what I have covered.
Well, thank you, and why don't I encourage you to stand there? Whilst I invite the audience to put questions or make observations on what was an extraordinarily wide-ranging as well as thought-provoking topic.
Geoffrey Owen was looking very thoughtful of his Leyland days, let alone his FT days.
Yes, sir.
So is that two questions or one?
Well, what is the reason that you think the companies are going to get larger from today on, whereas in the last 20 years, the larger companies seem to be having a smaller share?
Sure. Depends on how you measure it. If you look in terms of employment or even percentage of the economy, then I think small businesses are the... I mean, so if you look at the U.S. coming out of recession, out of all of its recent recessions, it's been... the small companies that have driven in terms of employment U.S. out of those out of the recessions, and I think that will remain true. And but there, what do I do?
I would just sort of shout.
It was a difficult question, after all. I think I organised that quite well. Didn't I can talk over the top of that? I don't think I can, do you? Hold on, stay with me. I'm trying to think of an answer. Right, I'm ready for the answer now. The I was a bit slow thinking, but the so don't let me dodge the fact that I think statistically I'm quite certain that will continue to be proved true. I think the other on the other hand, the other side of that is that there is been quite a development in management approach in large companies over recent years. We said a lot of the philosophies of how you ran a large company, going back, I don't know, perhaps it looked different because I wasn't running them then, but the going back into the 60s, 50s, 60s and 70s, I think increasingly large companies now have found some of the ways of where you can actually get individuals to drive on and how you can combine the drive of the individual into a large corporation without a lot of bureaucracy and so on. If one does that, then you can afford to run very large companies. I mean, so it was that I described as orchestrating anarchy, how you bring the best out of people and get them to work within a large operation without being held back by it. And there's no doubt that a lot of large companies were held back in the by their pure scale. They had become bureaucratic. They may have been private companies, but they suffered many of the problems of the large public sector companies. I think increasingly that's less true of the more successful large corporation. I mean, so they have actually found ways of, as I say, to use all the in expression, empowering the individual and harnessing. I mean, so the way I put that in picture language, always talking picture language, that's the only way I understand things. And the way I put that about Grand Met is that Grand Met is a small company that got big. And that's got a huge, like all my jokes, it's got, if you analyse them deeply enough, they're not the least bit funny, but they got a fair amount of truth in them. And it does actually describe the philosophy and the style of management of Grand Met very, very, very effectively. I mean, so we are, attitudinally, still very much a small company. I mean, so we happen to be now in Britain's top 12 largest companies by market valuation, but the whole of our attitude and drive and so on is towards the individual and so on. That's increasingly true of a lot of, unfortunately, it's true of a lot of our competitors, and so I think big companies will come along.
Geoffrey?
Halfway between 1 and 3, I think. Is
it's in talking about a company, right. Do you recommend that 2 is the right figure, or less, more, or does it depend on individual circumstances? I just wondered what the rationale of 2%
was. Right. I'm not certain there is one, Geoffrey. I mean, a lot of it is as it happened, but it's one is competitive practice, I mean, say it's, and that varies considerably, as you know, around the world. I mean, say our food operation is, our North American food operation is headquartered out of Minneapolis, which is almost the kind of headquarters of the state's social responsibility, as you know well. And to that extent, they have, for example, got a 10% club, which is people who give 10% of their profits to community projects. Hector Lang and many others drove the Percent Club, some people in this room are very familiar with it, in Britain, and which used to be the 1% club, but then became the Percent Club because we decided even 0.5% was better than none. So I guess the average in Britain is probably more like, let's say companies employ more than 200 people or something, let's say, what do we call it, medium and large companies, is probably more like, I guess 0.5%, but I don't know. I don't think the statistics actually exist. Most of our community involvement was driven bottom up. And we've now developed it as part of our ordinary management program. So it's got a kind of, it every year it presents its vision to the board of, you know, what it's supposed to be all about and what its priorities, as does every other business. It presents a three-year plan and then it has annual plan and everything else. So it's now just treated in the same way as any one of our businesses. And we think that 2% is, if anything, given where we are, is on the high side. It's, I mean, say 1.5 to 2%, with our mix of states and UK, we think would be about right. So we're probably, if anything, spending slightly too much. So what we're trying to do is to cut down the amount of money by being more effective and manage it better. And I think we've trimmed down. We were about 2.2%. We're now down to about 2. It's still very much an art form rather than a science, but it's becoming more mainstream. And as you know, business in the community. Stephen's wife, Stephen O'Brien, founder operator in the audience. Where's Stephen? He's still. I left him chairing the meeting. Oh, there you are, Stephen. Right, sorry, I shouldn't say something nice about him. I won't now. Stephen, very much founder. Stephen, 12 years ago, business in the community. So it's come a long way in that. But Stephen, where would you say, is my 0.5% about right, I guess?
I think it is, Alan, yes. I think that's probably on the higher end of what most companies are doing in the country. But as you said, it's extremely hard to evaluate precisely because everybody counts in a rather different way, even though many of the companies are run by accountants.
Yes, one of the things that the RSA will probably come out and say is that there should be, and said, whereas in annual reports you have to give the amount of statutory contribution to UK registered charities. That's probably the wrong expression, but something like that. Which doesn't actually mean much if you're an international company and whatever. So what should do is there should be a properly written statement, which a lot of companies now do, and business and the community encourage, of a statement on the community policies and philosophy and expenditure, as there is on environment and other subjects.
Yes, sir.
I sincerely hope so. No, I think the whole drive towards enterprise and so on, I think is quite fundamental. And there are going to be some companies that, some large companies and medium-sized companies, some small companies that fail, and therefore you've got to have a constant development of new trees or whatever they are coming along. One can be, if there's nobody here from the city, I'll say this, they're already worried about me as it is, but you can be entrepreneurial, of course, in a large company. A lot of the skill of large companies is to, as I put it, the advantage that Graham Met has got, we can turn our, we're 32 years old. I've been with them now almost 19 years. The thing that Graham Met can do, and as I say, unfortunately, so can some many of our competitors, is we can actually turn our battleship as fast as a destroyer. I was in the Paycor, so I don't know if that's a correct comparison. In other words, one can move quite quickly and quite entrepreneurially in a large company, and increasingly I think that's becoming true. But if you go back to your basic question, is would there be... the proportion of people going into self-employment straight from university must be dramatically higher, John, than it was. I never thought about it because nobody in my family had even been in management, let alone in self-employment. So I never even thought about it. But nowadays, I imagine every person coming out of university, and I'm cutting out all the jokes about whether they can get a job or not. They must quite very seriously think about, hey, do I want to work for anybody, or do I want to cut my teeth and learn my mistakes and then go into business on my own, and which is an absolute great trend, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I always, though, discourage students, I must say, because you do have to get everything right all at once, which is a bit rough. I always say go and work.
That's never stopped you, John, is it?
Well, I always say go and work for Grand Met for a year or two, get thoroughly trained, and then leave and become a competitor. But, so, yeah, good. Yes, sir.
This is a legal question. I'm a bit worried about this now. Do you know a good QC I can get advice from on this? That's true.
If it was a strongly unionized industry and the unemployment figures were much lower, and you've obviously got a lot of experience from the motor trade, would your philosophy, do you think, be to just as bad?
I think so. You're kind of captive of one's own experience, or whatever the expression is. But the so I may be the worst person to actually comment on that. But the going off at a tangent, while I think of the correct answer to your question, much of what happened to us in the 50s, 60s, 70s was as much to do with bad management. It's the fact that management actually delegated talking to its own staffs and left it to shop stewards, because it was much easier. So you couldn't possibly go out and talk to the chef, factory floor to people. So you got somebody else to do it, which used to be a foreman, and that went away, and then it became a shop steward. Whereas increasingly now, I think people would open up straight dialogue and so on, which worries us about some of the, don't let me mention European Works Councils, but the I think actually the what I'm describing is not actually a product of a political pressure, and is not actually a product of a kind of a unionised or non-unionised pressure. I think the answer to your question is yes, it would still apply. So I think if certainly the basic logic of what I said would, with hindsight, should have applied to Leyland, and probably could have applied to Leyland. But that's probably being clever with hindsight.
Yes.
Sure. It certainly has something to do with check and balance. There's no way that anybody should, or any group of people should set their own reward. And therefore, I'm a great believer in, and we've actually had most of 95% of what Cadbury proposed, Adrian Cadbury proposed in his report. We had before... Adrian's report came out. In fact, I was actually on the platform with him when he was presenting it. If you take the salary issue, so one should have very powerful non-executives, not dependent on the... in my view, one should have very powerful non-executives, not dependent in any way on the reward they get as being as non-executives, who would actually make the decisions on... How management should be kind of measured, rewarded, removed, or whatever, which has been true in our company for some time, long before I became, well, if you want me becoming chief executive and then chairman, was a decision driven by the non-execs. I think the whole subject of the level of salaries gets... in my view, I was described as one of the people. What was it? I was described as rich and infamous, and I knew I was infamous, but I never knew I was rich. But the and yet, if I was, there was a recent list of sports people that was published, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with sports people being paid well. And I think I was paid about the same way as one of the forwards of one of the Premier League football clubs. Which I guess means it's probably about right. So we've got to be terribly careful that we actually, if we're going to have a society which gives equality of opportunity, and I'm not saying I think we're much further forward than we were, then it's very important that we actually allow that society to be measured in one way that we measure it, which is cash. I've enjoyed every moment of being chairman of, that must be an exaggeration, but I've enjoyed on average most of the time of being chairman, chief executive, before that of Grand Met. Would I have done that if I hadn't been as rewarded as well as I've gone? I don't know. The easy answer, but it happens to be true, I'd have probably gone to the States. Because in the States, people would have actually said, hey, this guy's actually achieving a hell of a lot. Whereas in this country, they said, this guy's a twat. You know, what the hell is he doing? You know, does he know what he's doing? Is he on an ego trip or something? So I think, the basic answer to your question is check and balance and independent assessment.
Time for one last question, yes.
Right. And we'd have moved out, but they'd all been attempts. First of all, I think a lot of the community involvement and so on, I think virtually all of it must start at local level. I mean, so the worst thing you can do is to order somebody to volunteer, although I was 2 years in the army, and alternatively to be in a position where one has central approach, which doesn't mean anything to a local community. Therefore, I think you've actually got to begin on individual projects and ideas from the ground floor. And I think one of the advantages that business gets from community involvement is not only therefore improving local links, but also getting to know what the real world is like. So we do use, not on a huge scale, but we do use certainly volunteerism, but even kinds of commons and so on. It's part of our management development program. If you actually find a person blocked, or even if you don't, you can actually put a person into a community project, and it's quite interesting. You can give them experience there, as you know, that they probably couldn't get, I think, in a couple of years, that they probably wouldn't get in staying in a particular facet of business. I don't think I've actually found in the UK, Stephen, you're much closer to this than me. What would be a characteristic of UK as a generality? Would you find that it's that people aren't willing to kind of get out and get involved and so on? I've found that there's a huge amount of local drive, and and so on. How would you, because you know this side and the States. So one of the whole aims of business in the community, which has just evolved over the last dozen years, but one of its roles at the present moment in time is very much the exchange of, and increasingly would be true, is the exchange of best practice between companies and not only best practice within companies, but also try to draw the best practice out of the voluntary sector. And so increasingly, I think it's becoming more sophisticated in the UK, and I think we are catching up with the States. I wouldn't be pessimistic about it at all. The amazing thing is that a lot of this, as people said it would die, going back to some extent to a different facet of Tony's question, would it kind of die in the recession? Was a question that some people ask in a different environment. In fact, it didn't. The actual program of volunteerism of individuals, of corporate involvement and so on, continued right through. Obviously, some companies cut back. They had no choice. But by and large, it kept going quite well. And I'd be a kind of optimist for the future on it.
Well, I think that's a very nice note on which I should not only thank Alan on all your behalf for a fascinating insight into what, by any criterion, is one of our leading business thinkers in this area, for a stimulating lecture, but also I should, in drawing the proceedings to a close, thank the Barclay family, in the name of Clifford Barclay, have endowed this lecture, which is given annually by academics and business leaders on the general theme of enterprise. And the next challenge for all you enterprising people is to find your way to the informal reception in the senior dining room. And I apologize in advance for the fact that the lifts are rather slow. Anyway, Alan, on behalf of us all, thank you very much.